welcome to episode 81 of our podcast, Two Chairs Talking. My name is David Grigg, and I'm very pleased to welcome back my co-host, Perry Middlemiss, who has been middle-missing in action over the last couple of episodes. Ho, ho. Hi, Perry, and how was the trip?
Oh, okay, good. Thanks, you, David. We should tell our listener that we've just been having a lot of fun laughing about trying to remember the process about how we actually get this podcast episode started. You know, do I count down? Do I count up? Do I clap? What do I do? Who does what? Oh, no. So it's that's good to be back, David. It's good to be back talking to you again. It's been a little while. We pre-recorded one episode and then you handled one completely on your own. Thank you very much for doing so.
Oh, thanks to my guests, Rob Durand and Mary McLaughlin. That was very good.
Yeah, thank them very much as well. So that's great. So, I'm back. Got back about a week ago, and I think I'm slowly getting my head back into being back in Melbourne. But as I said just before the recording started to you, David, it's very weird being back in Melbourne in mid-October. And a week ago, I was in Alaska on a cruise, and it was warmer in Alaska than it is here. So that I find that to be really quite peculiar. And it's so wet, and went down to 5 degrees this morning, and it was cold.
Yeah.
So it's just weird being back. It just seems strange. But anyway, we're back. So get back into it now, and moving on down towards Christmas. That's the next big thing, I guess.
The next big thing, yes.
Oh, yeah.
So do you want to give us a little bit of a summary of the World Science Fiction Convention you were at?
Well, yes, I was at the Chicago World Science Fiction Convention. As you probably know, my World Science Fiction Convention is not the same as a lot of other people's, but really the convention is so big that everybody's experience is different. And you just have to find your own way through it all and work out what it is you want to do. According to the reports coming out of the convention, there were about 3,600 warm bodies on deck out of a total of about 6,000 members. So that was pretty good, being the first major convention in a couple of years. There was one in Washington last December, because they had to shift the dates because of COVID, and that was sort of had a low attendance rate. And the previous one, of course, was in New Zealand, and that was a completely virtual online convention. And 2019 in Dublin was the last big one, and that was a massive one. There was 5,000 or 6,000 of that one, and that was huge. So the news coming out of the convention is that of course, we know that next year's Worldcon is going to be held in Chengdu in China. We're still not terribly sure what the arrangements are going to be for that convention, because China is still going for a zero case policy for COVID, which means lockdowns all over the place, especially in Chengdu, by the sounds of things. I don't know what the current situation is. And at the moment, I don't know whether I'm going. And before ShyCon, I was probably 60-40 with the idea of going. I'm probably swung around now, and I'm probably 40-60 about going. So depending on how things turn out in the next couple of months, I'll have to make up my mind as to whether I'm going to get there or not. But we'll figure that out for next year. Anyway, the other news is that, as completely expected, Glasgow will now be the site of the 2024 World Science Fiction Convention. And I'm pretty much certain I'm going to that one. The wife and I have got a bit of a holiday idea lined up about what it is we would like to do with that one. So I'll be going to that. Of course, we don't know what's happening beyond that. Seattle's looking more likely for 25, but who knows? And beyond that, it's anybody's guess at this point.
Indeed.
But ShyCon itself, it seemed to be okay. They had a continual series of reports during the convention and also after it of the people that had been diagnosed with COVID. You can always guarantee that, of course, with any group of people maybe 10 to 20% walking around have either got it or are infectious. They had a policy of masks at all times in the convention area. So once you're outside the convention area, you could do as you wish. And so it may well be that people caught it outside outside the convention rooms, which just seems to be what happens a lot in these large events. But I got through it okay, didn't have any problems. Maybe it was just the people I was hanging out with, David, that were the ones that were doing okay. Or maybe the Chicago beer tended to kill all the germs. Because I drank a bit of that and had a bit of a good time, met up with a few people. Basically, my convention when I go to one of these things is that I go along to catch up with the people that I've known for a large number of years and haven't seen for a while, because I only ever see them every once every 2 years. In this case, sometimes it's been three. I haven't seen anybody since Dublin. And so catching up with them is good, meeting new people where you can. Caught up with New Zealand fan Nigel Rowe, who I hadn't seen for 30 years. The last time I saw him was when we were both living in London in the early 90s. He's now moved to Chicago with his wife, and so I caught up with him, and that was good. Caught up with old Melbourne resident Mark Linneman, who I hadn't seen for a few years. He's now retired and living in Sacramento. So it's good to catch up with these people that you haven't seen for quite some time, have a beer with them, have something to eat. And that's basically what I do. Did I attend any program items, you might ask, David? I went to a grand total of two program items. One was the Hugo Awards, because I had been asked to be an acceptor for Andrew Netty and Ian McIntyre for their book that was up for the best related work. Unfortunately, they didn't win, or maybe it was fortunate so that I didn't have to get up and actually say anything. But anyway, they didn't win. That was one event that I went to, and the other one was actually the closing ceremony.
Oh, there you go.
I completely missed the opening ceremony. I forgot that it was on. I didn't know when it was on. Finding your way through the program sometimes can be extremely difficult these days, because the Worldcons have, I don't know, 6 to 9 programming tracks. Whatever you want, you can find something if you're interested in comics or fanzines or hard science fiction or young adult dystopias or LGBTQI plus science fiction. If you're interested in fiction in translation, anything, whatever you want, you can basically find it at these Worldcons. And as I said, you could basically go, you could know that somebody else was there and they could have an interest that didn't overlap yours, and you would never see them. Because they would always be in program items that you weren't going to, and you may never run across them, or run across them rarely. I mean, I met Ararat fan James Stiles twice at the convention in passing in the dealer's room, and he's somebody that I haven't seen in donkey's ages, and I only ever see him at Worldcons, and he lives in Ararat. He's only about an hour and a half away. But that's basically because he's a train driver, and he has a tendency to be all over the country with his driving his trains, and doesn't get down to Melbourne much, or doesn't get to functions that we go to. But occasionally you come across people that, you know, you just haven't seen for ages. And it's good. From that perspective, that's why I like them. But I can understand that people might find them either daunting or incomprehensible. But everybody's Worldcon's different. And I enjoyed mine, so that's all
That's good. Do you want to make comment at all about the Hugos?
Well, yeah, a little bit. The Hugo Awards, I'll just talk a little bit about the fiction awards more than anything else. I mean, Desolation Called Peace by Arkady Martin. Yeah, I mean, I had that as number two because I had She Who Became the Sun as number one. But I could understand why A Desolation Called Peace picked up the award. It's a well-written, interesting novel, and I'm not unhappy about that one. The best novella was a Psalm for the Wild built by Becky Chambers. Well, we've discussed this, and you know, there's a certain. It's a feel good novella. I'm of the view that I've having read all the stuff that she's written that this is the best of the stuff that she's done, but it still doesn't mean to say that it's. I thought it was the best novella there. My choice was A Spindle Splintered by Alex E. Harrow. Yours may have been different, David. I'm not sure, but
mine was different. But I thought that I could have reversed the order entirely. I could have just turned it upside down, and that would have been my order, just about.
Yeah. Okay. Pretty much. Yeah. So it just goes to show that we've a little
what
bit.
What do
different.
We know?
Bots of the Lost Ark. No, I had Colors of the Immortal Palette by Carolyn M. Yochim.
Yep, me too.
But I think we both agreed that Where Oak and Hearts Do Gather by Sarah Pinsker was the best of the short stories.
And, that's because all the rest were rubbish.
Oh, really?
Mr. Death was kind of all right.
Yeah, but okay. But Where Oak and Hearts Do Gather, well, it was innovative, interesting, and it made you think about it. And actually, after you read it, made you want to go back and read it again. And there's very, very few of those around these days that actually make you want to do that.
Yeah, I mean, it was a good story, but I say that the rest were, it was a very poor field.
Very poor field.
Anyway.
Best series went to Wayward Children by Shauna Maguire. Well, yeah, that's okay. She seemed to be going up all the time, Shauna Maguire, to pick up awards, but that was okay. And best dramatic presentation, Dune. Yeah, I'm happy with that. I thought that I know a lot of people have complained about it, saying it's only half a story. Well, duh, it is only half a story.
That's right.
And you're only getting it up to a certain point. Yes, we all know that it's sort of a hero's journey, and it's But this got you can complain about it all you like, but geez, it looked good and it sounded good. And I really should go back and see it again in a on a big screen. But it'll be interesting to see what's up for best film next year. As in, my tip at this stage is Everything Everywhere All at Once, which I think is an absolutely stunningly good and funny film. As to whether the Chinese like it, will be another matter entirely.
Yeah, well, it'll be interesting to see.
Interesting to see. I will certainly be nominating that for putting that on my nomination ballot for next year. Hmm. But we'll see what happens when that comes about. But overall, the Hugo Awards was the ceremony. At least was quick. It was all over in a bit over 2 hours. Two and a half hours, which is pretty damn good. Normally they run for about four, when they're sort of interminable, and you know, after a while you start thinking, I've got to get out of here to go to the toilet. Mm. But it didn't have that problem this time, and it was pretty good. I was a bit nervous sitting there. Was the work that I was going to be representing going to be called? But it wasn't, so I didn't have to worry about it from that perspective, but it was a bit nerve-wracking sitting there.
It's very
draining. Yeah. I didn't realise how draining it was, just sitting there in the audience thinking, could possibly be me having to go up there. Mm. I mean, I've spoken in front of, 1996, when I was the Duff candidate in LA, the LA Convention Hugo Awards ceremony probably had 4,000 or 5,000 people in it. And I had to give out two awards. That's probably the largest crowd that I've spoken in front of. And the interesting thing there is that the lights are so bright, you can only see the first two rows.
Yeah, that's right.
And the good thing about that is you know there's other people out there, but because you can't see the faces and you can't see how they're reacting, you can only see the first couple of rows, so that sort of makes it a heck of a lot easier. Well, it was for me. Might be different for other people. But anyway. It worked okay. And I think overall that people could say that there were a lot of problems with the convention, but I didn't see them.
Well, convention doesn't have problems, yes.
Well, exactly right. I mean, basically, I think we all decide that after having run one, that the thing that you want a convention to do is for it to look like a duck in the water, serenely gliding across the top of the water, but underneath a flurry of activity, keeping it moving in one direction. And as long as the people above the water can't see what's going on below the water, then everything just flows beautifully. And for me, it did. I'm not down in the depths of the mechanics of conventions anymore, and so I'm not down there, and I'm certainly not going to criticise anybody for whatever things they do, because you and I, David, have both been at the top and we know what it's like, and we don't want to go there again.
No way. All right, let's roll on to some general news.
Yes.
In fact, we're going to note really just a few deaths, unfortunately. And the first one I'll talk about is that of Hilary Mantel. I thought it was very sad to read of her death. She was only 70 years old. She's the British author of the brilliant historical series. I thought it was brilliant. Historical series about Thomas Cromwell in Tudor times. The books comprising Wolf Hall, Bring Up the Bodies, and The Mirror and the Light. And apparently one of her earliest novels, the one she actually started writing first, were in 1974. It was a book about the French Revolution, which took ages to find a publisher and came out in 1992 and won an award, Sunday Express Book of the Year Award. And that sounds very interesting, about the French Revolution, so I might try and find that at some stage and read up about it. But she'd had an interesting life. She'd lived in Botswana and lived in Saudi Arabia for a number of years. She did say that leaving Saudi Arabia felt like the happiest day of her life, according to Wikipedia. Anyway, interesting. So yes, it's sad to see her go at that early age. She could have had several other great works in progress, but we won't see them.
Yeah.
You have a couple, I think, Perry?
I do. First off is horror writer Peter Straub. He's died just recently at the age of 79. He was the winner of the Bram Stoker Award, the World Fantasy Award, and International Horror Guild Award. We don't really read much in the way of horror on this, David, but really, I suppose we really should read some of the more of the top-end stuff. And Straub is one of those that actually fits into that category. Because a bit like crime fiction, horror fiction is not just about what the genre depicts it as. So crime fiction is not just about the crime. It's also a social commentary. A lot of what we read in the crime fiction genre is as much a social commentary on what's going on in the country in which it's set as it is about the crime or the mystery that's at the heart of it. And same as with horror. Straub basically hit his straps after three or four early novels with Ghost Story in 1979. Which is really a great horror story all over, and was made into a film in 1981 with Fred Astaire, Melvin Douglas, Douglas Fairbanks Jr. and John Houseman. And I remember watching that film and being really impressed by it, and I was thinking that, I really should go back and have a look at that again, and a bit of a homage to Peter Straub, and, maybe I can get you to read a horror story about that. No, it's not that bad. A horror story.
Maybe
it's a story that cuts across generations, and so you see the men as a young men, and then later on when they come back into town and they have to face what happened to them when they were younger. Anyway, so Straub followed up Ghost Story with the novel Shadowland, great book. Floating Dragon, don't think I've read that one. And then before releasing The Talisman in 1985, which he co-authored with Stephen King. And then he and King also delivered Black House in 2001. And Straub was the author overall of about 17 novels and 5 short story collections. So a decent career and well-regarded within the field, not just in the horror field, but also in the genre field in general. So he's a great loss, as is the loss of Maureen Kincaid Speller, who has died recently at the age of 63. So this is very, well, for us, it's very young, isn't it, David? I mean, it's terrible. So Maureen, I knew Maureen a little. I met her a few times, really enjoyed her company. She was an SF fan and critic and was active in SF fandom from around about 1980. And she published a number of fanzines and founded Acnestis, which a number of our friends, like Bruce Gillespie, were members of, which was a UK Amateur Press Association, or APA. She founded this in 1992 and continued to help administer it until the APA closed in 2005. Since 2015, Maureen was the senior reviews editor at Strange Horizons magazine, where she began working in 2006. She was the partner of SF critic Paul Kincaid and had been since 1986, and they were married in 1993, and he survives her. And he's been talking about his problems of losing her on Facebook recently, and it's been a bit, it's been very sad. It was just very quick. Everything came together very quickly this year, and follows on from the loss of Judith Henner last year. And so we're losing these people. You're way too young, David. Really. Way too young. Anyway, but she will be remembered.
Yeah, indeed. All right, do we want to roll on to after that to reading, what we've been reading recently?
Yes, well, we'll talk about what we've been reading lately, and there'll be a bit of a theme in terms of what I've been reading.
Mostly, because, yes, there's a couple which aren't quite in the theme, but yeah, there we go.
Yeah, but mostly a theme purely because it's been holiday reading, and you know what holiday reading's like, David. You basically pick up a bit, and you've got to have something that you know that you can pick it up after not having touched it for a couple of days, because either you've been too busy and you're just too tired to actually get to it. But I was interested in reading the second book in Mick Herron's series about the Slough House, and this one's called Dead Lions. As I said, this is the second in his series, and it was the winner of the CWA Gold Dagger Award for Best Novel when it was published. Mm-hmm. So that's pretty high praise for this. And we've spoken about the first book and also about the TV series with Gary Oldman appearing as the main character, Jackson Lamb. We've spoken about that. And the second season, which is based on Deadlines, should be out sometime in the next month or so.
2nd of December, I believe.
So 6 weeks, six, 7 weeks.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I'm glad that I got to read this beforehand so that I know basically... Hopefully, I know what's basically going on. Anyway, so the story starts off when an old man is found dead on a rail replacement bus outside Oxford somewhere in England. But the police generally aren't at all interested in what's going on. They just consider it as another case of a death by natural causes. This old guy just died on the bus, and so what's there to know about? But Jackson Lamb, who I've spoken about, the head of Slough House, where British agents go after they've, you know, been washed out or they've stuffed up in some sort of action that they're supposed to be dealing with. Jackson Lamb isn't so sure. It comes out that the dead man, Dickie Bow, interesting name. Obviously, his name is Richard something Bow, and his nickname is Dickie Bow. Dickie Bow was an old spook. He wasn't one of the top rank, but he was, you know, one of those hangers-on that used to do a bit of work with the British intelligence services in Europe. And Jackson Lamb actually worked with him when he was in Europe. Now, the one thing that Dickie Bow had that was unique for the intelligence services is that he claimed to have seen a person by the name of Popov, who was an elusive Soviet agent who many thought to be a fictitious KGB diversionary tactic. But Dickie Bow was absolutely certain that this guy was around. And Lamb sort of trusted him enough to think that, you know, maybe this guy Popov might really have been a real person. So is that a sort of a double bluff by the KGB? So Lamb sets out to investigate what's happened to poor old Dickie, sending out his slow horses, as they are referred to, out to gather information while he works the inner halls of the intelligence services, trying to figure out what everybody knows and what everybody knows about either Dickie Bow or about Popov. Now, all of the characters from the first novel in this series appear, well, those that are left anyway, because there's at least one of them that died in the first one, along with a couple of newcomers. But it's really Lamb who we come to know a lot better here than we did in the first book. And that's a good thing, because Lamb's a, as we've said in the past, he's a very interesting character. He's... It's not that he's prejudiced. He just hates everybody, David. He just doesn't really get on with everybody.
Equal opportunity hater.
Yeah, he's equal opportunity hater. He basically, he treats everybody poorly, gives them a hard time, criticises them in front of everybody else. He's probably the worst manager that you could ever possibly think of face-to-face. But behind the scenes, he actually has a little bit of... Well, he's got a little bit of affection for the people that come to work for him, especially the ones that actually show that they've got a bit of talent, even though they might have stuffed up somewhere else. And the author, McHerrin, here is obviously writing this as a very long series of novels where Lamb is going to be the character where he's going to slowly eke out a little bit more about him as he goes. If you like to think of him, he's the complete opposite in so many ways from George Smiley, Le Carre's main character, except for the fact that both of them are incredibly intelligent and have a lot of insight into terms of what's going on. So there's a lot of concentration on Jackson Lamb in this particular book, and the book's actually better for it. And this novel is actually darker and funnier than the first one, which was good because I thought the first one was pretty funny. The plot's more devious and convoluted. And so, you know, I reckon that once you start reading this particular series, you'll want to keep going back to it. There's enough in these books for you to sort of think, yeah, I really like these, and I'm just going to keep on reading them one every 6 months or so until I catch up, and then he's doing one every year or two. And so that's a nice run. There's about seven or eight in the series so far, something like that. I gave this one 4.2 out of 5. Really enjoyed it. And I would heartily recommend this to anybody. The great stuff. And if you like the TV series, read the books.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I've got the first book on hold at the library, but of course I'm like number 80 out of 106 people in the queue. So it's going to be a while. I might have to buy a copy. Oh dear. But there you go. It might come to that. It might come to that. One thing we forgot to mention last time when we were talking about slow horses, and you said then, as you did now, how much of an opposite Jackson Lamb is to George Smiley. We failed to pick up on the fact that, of course, Gary Oldman has played both roles.
Yes.
In movies.
Miss that. And that's interesting. You know, and he did a very good Smiley in that film version. I mean,
he's such a good actor.
I don't think the film version is as good as the Alec Guinness TV series because the TV series was able to basically, over six or so episodes, being able to examine every single little piece of that particular book. And it's an excellent, Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, it's an excellent novel.
Yeah.
Regardless of whether you think it's, again, it's one of those things where it's more about character than it is about the mystery, although that mystery inside the intelligence services is vitally important. But it just tells you a lot about the relationships between Britain and the Soviet Union, a lot about what was going on inside Britain at the time, and also a lot about the inner workings of the intelligence services. And more you hear about them, the more and more you hear that they're just a total woeful mess down there. And it's all about privilege and who knows what. And, oh, no, he's one of us, and therefore he would never do that sort of thing. And, you know, all the things that have gone on in the British intelligence services since the Second World War with,
Kim Philby and so on.
Philby and all the rest of them, you know. Anyway, it's wonderful stuff. Look, it's just got vast areas where people can get into and write really good novels about. And McHerrin is writing a really damn good set of novels here, and I recommend it.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I'm looking forward to getting into those. So I'll start talking about my first book. And this is the book which we had the Ned Kelly Awards recently. And this book won the Best International Fiction at the recent Ned Kelly's, and that is The Maid by Nita Prose. And this is an easy read, feel-good kind of story, although it's crime. So it's told from the first-person point of view of Molly Gray, who's a maid at the Regency Grand Hotel in a major American city. I'm not sure that we're ever told what city it is, but anyway, it's a major American city. So Molly's generally happy and content in her job. She loves cleaning and tidying, and she does so with a high degree of perfection. But Molly is different. Maybe she's somewhat autistic, something like that. It's hard to tell because we only ever see her from her own point of view. It's a first-person point of view. But as she says of herself, I often have trouble with social situations. It's as though everyone is playing an elaborate game with complex rules that they all know, but I'm always playing for the first time. Now, this difference means that other staff find her odd and they make fun of her, and they give her mocking nicknames like Roomba after the robotic vacuum cleaner because she's so dedicated to cleaning. And so her innocence and her naive view of the world means that she's often taken advantage of. She had the nest egg that her grandmother had been accumulating for her stolen by an unscrupulous boyfriend. Her supervisor at the hotel regularly steals the tips left out for her. All of this means that she struggles to pay the rent on her rundown apartment. So the main plot of the book starts with Molly discovering the dead body of Mr. Black, who's one of the guests in the hotel. And it's not long before the police decide that Black was murdered. He was extremely rich, divorced, and onto his second trophy wife, Gina, who he had been physically abusing. And prior to Black's death, Molly and Gina had struck up a pretty good, friendly relationship. We also discover that Molly's simple nature has led her to being involved in a nefarious scheme, leading her to come under suspicion of involvement in Black's death. She is, in fact, being framed for murder, but she's not entirely without friends to help her out. So I won't go into any more detail about the course of the book, but the interest really is in Molly's character and her predicament. As I say, she's charged with murder and, you know, she's such an innocent, naive person. You think that she's going to end up being thrown in jail for a crime she didn't commit. But, you know, the interest in her character carries you along, and you're quickly invested in wanting her to triumph and have a chance at a better life. So yeah, I thought it was entertaining and enjoyable, perhaps not very deep or challenging, but yeah, it was a pleasant read.
Okay, right. Sounds interesting. I'll Ned Kelly's the International Book Award hasn't been around for terribly long, so it's probably trying to find its feet. But sounds like this is one that.
No, I think it's probably worth it. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Well, to continuing on the crime front, we didn't actually set this episode up as being a crime fiction episode, but it seems they're going to be working towards that. But it's just what I find easy to read when I'm travelling, as I said earlier. And my next one is C is for Corpse by Sue Grafton. I've discussed the first two, A is for Alibi and B is for Burglar, in this particular series. And this is the third, as you can tell, by C is for Corpse. And was the winner of the Anthony Award for Best Novel. And the Anthony Awards are given out each year for crime fiction. There's three or four major awards given out in the US for crime fiction each year. The Edgar, the Anthony, the Barry Award. And then, of course, there's the CWA, Crime Writers Association, which sounds like it's from America, but it's actually based in the UK. They also give out awards. And that's what was Dead Lions won that one. This one is a winner of the Anthony Award for Best Novel in the year in which it was written. Can't quite remember the year. So early, sometime in the 80s, I believe. Anyway, so this is one of Sue Grafton's Kinsey Mahoney series of novels. In this one, Kinsey's working out at the gym, recovering from the injuries that she received at the end of the previous book. When she meets a young man by the name of Bobby Callahan, who's also there, he's recovering from injuries that he received when his car ran off the road and crashed 9 months previously. Now, he's feeling a heck of a lot of guilt because his best friend was sitting in the front seat with him and he died after being thrown from the car, but Bobby Callahan survived. But he's been left with a large number of physical injuries as well as some memory loss. But Callahan starts talking to Mahoney and realizes and knows that she's a private investigator, and hires her to look into his past because he can't quite remember what happened. But he believes that he was actually run off the road, so that somebody was attempting to kill him. But he can't work out why, and he can't remember, and he doesn't All he has is this conviction that somebody ran him off the road and attempted to kill him. So she basically starts off and starts looking into things as she does. And from there, from this basic beginning, we move into sort of classic Californian PI territory. So you come, it all comes together with a rich family with secrets, drug abuse issues, and a lot of them have got psychiatric problems. It seems to be that they go to hand in hand with Californian rich families, especially in Private Eye novels. And so she's basically looking into this. And then a few days later, Bobby is actually killed in another car accident, which the police put down to him having a seizure, saying that he basically, from his injuries that he received in his previous accident, he shouldn't have been driving, but he was, had a seizure and crashed it and died. Mulholland is not really completely convinced about this. And even though a client is dead, he had given her enough of a retainer for her to continue to carry on her investigation. And as she slowly starts to piece together Bobby's past life, trying to work out what happened to him and how he came to be dead. Now, the novel takes a while to get going as the author sets up the interrelationships between the family members and there are sordid hangers-on and the people that were looking after drug addict daughter who were looking after Bobby, who seemed to be looking after the mother. Everybody seems to have somebody looking after them, doing something for them and being paid, of course, because that's what they do. But the novel starts, takes a while to get going, but really starts to motor on once it gets into the second half of the particular, of this book. And this, in many ways, is a step up from the previous two books in this series. I didn't think it was going to be in the first half, but then it really kicks into life in the second. Then you realise what the author's done in terms of all the setup and how it had to be done in a certain way for her to be able to get to the point where she can move towards the end of the mystery. Mm-hmm. And you can see that Grafton's really getting into a really good groove here in terms of her writing style. It's picked up quite a lot. She doesn't feel the need to be putting everything up front, in front of you. She basically feels that she can lay things out in a steady process and then bring it all together at the end. Now, these aren't not long books. These are only about 200 to 240 pages each. Perfect. Mm. Perfect PI length, you know. Mm. You should basically be running things. If you can get it done in that time, just do it. There's nothing superfluous about this here. You don't have four or five different sort of threads going around all over the place. You've got a couple, but they're all associated with Maloney's private life and where she lives and the people that she lives with and her friends. And she passes them and in the book, and they basically still, there's an onward movement of those relationships that's going on here. So I think Grafton, as I said, is really getting into a good groove, and she puts it firmly in line with the works of Ross Macdonald, which, of course, she basically was following along behind. And these are pretty good private investigator stuff. Classic Private Eye book novels that are worth your while. I gave this one 3.9 out of 5.
Mm. Oh, very good. All right, I'm going to move on to Lying Beside You. Again, this is someone, Michael Robotham, who's written an awful lot of books, but most of them are very good. And this, Lying Beside You, is the third book in his series about Cyrus Haven, who is a psychologist working with local police, and a young woman, Evie McCormack, who's the survivor of traumatic childhood sexual abuse and who has a remarkable ability to detect when someone's lying to her, I think because she's had so much experience of people lying to her through her childhood. But Cyrus has his own traumatic background. When he was about 14 years old, his elder brother, Elias, suffering from delusions due to schizophrenia, rampaged through their family home with a knife and killed Cyrus's parents and his twin sisters. Cyrus himself only escaped because he was still returning home from football practice. He was about 14 at the time. And Elias was then placed in a secure psychiatric facility where he's remained for the last 20 years. As this novel opens, however, Elias is being considered for release into the community, which in practice means that he's going to have to live with Cyrus. Now, although Cyrus has forgiven Elias because of the mental illness that he understood that Cyrus was suffering, the prospect's still daunting, all the more so because Evie Cormack, now turned 21, has been living as a housemate, but not in a relationship, with Cyrus for the last few years. He's very uncertain how Evie and Elias will get on together, and indeed, these two are quickly at odds in the household, fighting about which room they're allowed to be in and what's other things that are going on in the house. And so throughout the novel, there's this uncertainty about whether Elias could revert to his murderous state and kill everybody in the house again. Now, with all that in the background, Cyrus is asked to assist in a case in Nottingham in which an elderly man has been found bashed to death in his own home. And his grown-up daughter, Maya, with whom he was living, is now missing. Evidence at the scene indicates a sexual motive. Then when a second young woman is abducted from outside the bar where Evie is working as a casual waitress, Evie too becomes involved in the investigation. But her traumatic childhood means she has trouble thinking through the consequences of her actions. In some way, she's still very childlike. It means that she doesn't think things through about what's going to be the consequence of what she does. And she blunders badly while trying to investigate an earlier case which seems similar to these recent abductions. Eventually, again, I won't get into too much detail about the rest of the plot, but eventually, of course, Cyrus and Evie find the connections between these three cases, and they work out where the abducted women are being held. And then there's an unexpected role for Cyrus's brother, Elias, who, as I say, has been sitting there like a volcano. You're sort of expecting to erupt at any moment during the plot. He erupts in an unexpected way. So it's all excellent page-turning writing. I do think that, as is often the case with crime novels, you do start to become a bit cynical about the coincidences that you're expected to swallow. You know, what are the odds that Evie would be a witness to the second woman being abducted, or that Cyrus would give a casual gardening job to a paroled prisoner who turns out to have been imprisoned for a crime with connections to the other abductions? Still, it's all good stuff. Evie's character and her view of the world continue to be unusual and carry the story along well. She's really more dominant in this novel than Cyrus, and it's interesting to see her feelings towards him slowly start to develop. They've had this almost adversarial relationship ever since he originally became involved in her case when she was several years younger. And so while he still holds her at arm's length and describes her to others as his housemate or even as his tenant, she is starting to have different feelings. This relationship clearly has some distance to go, and I imagine that we'll see that played out in subsequent novels in this series. But yeah, it was good. I mean, the first two novels, I didn't mention their names. The first one in the series was Good Girl, Bad Girl, which introduces us to Evie Cormack. And the second one was When She Was Good, which really explores her background and how she came to be the way she is. So they're all very good, all very much well worth reading. And this was a good extension to that series, I thought.
Okay. All right. I'm a long way behind on Michael Rowbotham's novels.
Oh, he's written such a lot.
There are too many series around, and I've got a couple more books to come, both of which are in series. The next one, though, is the only one in this particular series that I intend to read, and it's the 18th. I just happened to pick it up. I was floating through a small town in Canada, and we dropped off to have a bit of a look around and found a small little secondhand shop, and I went in and there was a book, and I thought, oh, I've heard of Brad Thor. Wonder how much it is. I asked them, and they said, just put a donation in. So I gave them $5. He said, well, $5 seems like a lot of money. And I said, well, it's a good condition secondhand novel. I don't think $5 is terribly much. In fact, I felt a little bit guilty only giving him $5. But anyway, I picked this up because I'd heard about it, and can't remember whether I'd heard terribly good things about it, but I had heard about this guy's particular series of novels starring his main character, Scott Harvath, H-A-R-V-A-T-H. So I'm pronouncing that Harvath. David, if you ever want to read a Marvel superhero story in book form, then this is probably it. I presume that the rest of the series is pretty much along the same sort of lines. If you think of a character like Captain America, but without the super serum, so he's just sort of a normal guy, and I put that in inverted commas, but with a greater sense of self-righteous patriotism, more willingness to use extreme violence as a method of retribution, and an overblown and misdirected sense of revenge at all costs, then you've probably got a good idea about what this character is all about. And Lady Luck, he seems to have a sort of a very precious relationship with Lady Luck that defies all sense of probability. You were talking about coincidences previously. Yeah. This guy just basically, you know, it's like everybody that he's up against is a bit like, you know, the stormtroopers from Star Wars. You know, you can stand there, you know, in the middle of a corridor and they will, 10 stormtroopers will shoot at you and none of them will ever hit you. That sort of stuff. Or if they do, it's just a graze, you know, Western. So in many ways, this is sort of like a Western, but it's... Anyway, look, I'll explain what the story's about and maybe you get a bit of an idea about what's going on. Okay. So the novel starts where Harvath wakes up and he doesn't know where he is, but he knows that he's handcuffed, he's been muzzled, or he's got something over his head, and there's a hell of a lot of noise around, and he realises that he's actually in an aircraft. And from the voices that are around him, he's been surrounded by a whole lot of Russian soldiers. So he's actually in a military helicopter. And in flashback, he slowly starts to remembering what's happened to him, that he was captured while he was in America. He was at a house with three close friends, one of whom had been his mentor for a long period of time, who was very unwell with dementia and dying, and they'd all gone to see him before this old guy died, when a whole bunch of Russians burst into the house, shot the other three, and captured him. And one of the other three, you find out later on, was somebody that he was romantically involved with. Harvath is now being tortured and interrogated, and he now finds himself in extreme bad weather in an aircraft, because in this helicopter that's bouncing around all over the place. And of course, yeah, the helicopter starts coming apart in midair, and it looks like it's going to crash, which it does. And of course, of all the people on the plane, he's able to get himself off because, you know, because basically the pilot says you have to basically uncuff him because, you know, he's got to be able to get out of the plane if something goes wrong. And, you know, you've got to take the hood off him. So they do all of that. And of course, he gets out. And then he sets out for revenge on everybody that's done anything to him regarding this particular murder and abduction. And he spends 300 pages doing this.
Oh, dear.
And on and on and on and on it goes. And, you know, you lose track of the number of people that he kills. You lose track of the amount of how many injuries that he gets. But he still just keeps on going, David. It's like the Ever Ready Bunny. You know, he just goes. You know, once he's off and going, there's no stopping him.
Mm-hmm.
So there isn't really a lot to this book. It's a page turner because you know, look, if you want to get a template for how a novel of this particular type is going to be written, this is probably as good as you're going to get. You know, the sentences are short and punchy. There's two or three sentence paragraphs, 6 to 8 page chapters. What's that? What do they reckon? Should be 6 to 8 pages, about the amount of time that a bloke spends in the toilet so that he can read a chapter and then that's all you have to do. And most of the chapters end in cliffhangers, so it's always building the tension up. And so from that perspective, if you're looking for a template on how to write these things, this is probably about as good as you get. The action's short, sharp and frenetic. Everything's over and done with really quickly, and the pacing drives you forward all the time. And I'm absolutely certain that he's got all of his... the use of his weapons, the weather in certain places, the military equipment, all the rest of that stuff is probably absolutely spot on. The list of acknowledgements at the end and all the people that he thanks and in the military and everywhere in the diplomatic services and so on is, you know, absolutely huge. And so I'm absolutely certain he's got all of this covered. If you're looking for a right-wing thriller, that basically just powers ahead and with no remorse and no sense of guilt. You've wronged me, and therefore I'm going to kill everybody. But it gets to the point where the way that he gets away with all of the stuff that he does is sort of comic book in its way that it does it. And I don't mean to denigrate comics at all, because I really like them, but there's a certain level of storytelling that, you know at the start that Captain America, regardless of whoever he's attacking or being attacked by on the front cover, is going to make it through to the end of this particular comic. Same thing with this guy. It's just going to keep on going. I'm not going to read any more of these. One's enough. I'm not going to... Unless it turns up and wins an award, and I'll check back in again, or if it's on any best of lists, best of thrillers of the last 20 years, I might basically have a bit of a look at it if it's a different one from this one. By the way, I don't think I actually gave the name of this book, which is Backlash, written by Brad Thor. I gave this one 2.7, and I'm basically thinking that I really should give it a lower figure. There's one interesting thing about this. This is the very first time that I'd ever come across the non-military Soviet group known as the Wagner Group. Now, just in the last couple of days, I've been hearing the Wagner Group mentioned on the news regarding the Soviet invasion of Ukraine. Mm-hmm. Now, this is a non-military mercenary group that's basically answerable purely to the Russian president. And they have a very major role in this particular book. But it's the first time that I'd ever seen it. And this is from 2019. Mm. So that is of interest. But this is really a black and white book, David. There's absolutely nobody on the other side that's got any white to them. And there's nobody on his side that's got any black to them. There's no grey here. It's just bang, bang, shoot 'em ups, and that's it. But, hey, you have to... Sometimes you have to read outside your comfort zone, David. This is certainly outside mine. I don't intend going back out there again.
Fair enough. Well, you said there's no shades of grey in yours. Well, this book I'm going to talk about is almost all shades of grey. It's interesting. So this book is Benjawan by Josh Kemp. And this won the Ned Kelly Awards, won the Best Debut Novel. And it's very, very well worth that award, I think. It's a confronting, disturbing book. It deals, among many other things, with drug addiction and the way that it can drive addicts to live a degraded, desperate life and to carry out actions which are violent, disgusting, or just plain morally abhorrent. More importantly, it looks at the children of addicts and the lives they are forced to live. So, there are two main point of view characters. The first is a young man called Gareth Hoyle, who is addicted to the hallucinogenic drug PCP. And when we first encounter him, he's in the outback in Western Australia, north of Kalgoorlie, slightly crazy and needing to get another fix of his drug. But he's, say, wandering around in the bush and is absorbed by the wonder of the Australian landscape. And Gareth's background and history are revealed through the course of the book in pieces. And this slow revelation is very smoothly done. It's integrated well with the ongoing action. So we discover that he used to work as a shearer on a sheep station called Benjawan near Leonora, and that he's written a successful non-fiction book. This book is a key to most of the novel. So it was a non-fiction true crime book about his experiences at Benjawan, and in particular about the search for a child who went missing from the station. In the book, Gareth changed the names of the people he lived with at Benjawan, but each person is readily identifiable. The book was a great success, and Gareth made a fair bit of money from it, but the other people that he lived with at Benjawan are deeply angry about the book for various reasons, the way that he's depicted them. Now, the other main character in the book is a child, a 10-year-old girl calling herself Luna, though that's not her real name. And when we first meet her, she's locked herself into a toilet in a house somewhere. And from time to time, men come along and rattle the doorknob and demand to be let in, but she refuses. Someone called Geordie, who looks after Luna, apparently, has told her to stay there and not let anyone in until he gets back. but she's been waiting a long time. Gareth discovers Luna when he travels to Kalgoorlie and meets up with Kez, or Karen, who was one of the people at Banjowarn. She too is an addict, and he wants her to help him score. She's bitter at him for his depiction of her as a hopeless junkie in the book, but he eventually persuades her to take him to her dealer. And it's in this drug house that Gareth, more or less accidentally, breaks into the toilet where Luna is hiding. Without trying to describe the rest of the book in detail, Gareth finds himself having to look after Luna when it's discovered that Geordie, the man that Luna had been living with, has died from a drug overdose after leaving her in this place. Gareth refuses to take Luna to the child protection authorities because his own life was one of being shuttled from one foster family to another. He just doesn't want that to happen to her. And so instead he promises to take Luna back to live with her father, who apparently lives in the town of Gwalia near Leonora. And so the deeply troubled relationship between these two people, the man and the child, is at the heart of the book. Gareth keeps trying to avoid responsibility and retreat to his drugs and his love of the outback, while she has fixated onto him as a guardian, while knowing that he, like many adults that she's known in her short life, has a bad drug habit and is likely to let her down, as he does frequently. So the book comes to a shatteringly violent conclusion at Banjowarn Station. Now, this apparently is a real place, Banjowarn, which has an astonishing but true past history, which I won't reveal. Read the book. I thought this was all excellently done, although the book is often difficult to read because of the subject matter and its brutally honest depiction of drug addiction and its consequences. I thought it was excellent. I thought it was a very worthy winner of the Ned Kelly Award for Best Debut Crime Fiction. I certainly look forward to seeing anything else that he writes.
Okay, I shall keep an eye out for that one.
Yeah, well worth reading.
Yeah, first novels, it's good to keep an eye on those awards that recognise first novels, because you can sometimes get in on the ground floor of a person's writing career that you would normally miss. And the first novel award is something that will give you an indicator that the person has a lot of talent. Now, it doesn't always work that they carry on and keep going, but you know, sometimes they do, and it sounds like this one. This author's got a fair bit of talent and a fair bit of ability, and worthwhile keeping an eye on. So,
yeah.
All right, we shall do that in the years ahead, David. Hopefully, I'm back with another crime novel, as we always seem to be doing today. Should really have called this one our crime. Anyway, it doesn't matter. But I'm looking at an Australian series of novels, and I've gradually been working my way through them. These are the series of novels that deal with Detective Inspector Napoleon Bonaparte, otherwise known as Boney. Now, these are written by Arthur Upfield in the 30s, 40s, 50s and 60s, and there were 29 of these all up. The one that I'm reading here is Mr. Jelly's Business, which is the fourth in that particular series. Now, if you're not aware of who Boney is, he's a mixed-race Indigenous Australian detective working for the Queensland Police Force. He's sort of, in some ways, a bit egotistical. He likes to think of himself as the world's best tracker and also the world's best detective. But if the stories are anything to go on, he's bloody right. He's really, really good. And so it's a lot of the detail and the attraction of these particular novels are not only about the settings, the Australian settings, sometimes the crime, but I'll talk about this one in a bit, but also about Bonaparte himself and also how he deals with his interactions, mostly with the white community, but also with the Indigenous Australian communities of the time. In this case, it's all with the white communities in a small wheat belt town in Western Australia. Now, I said that Boney's a member of the Queensland Police Force, but he does like to get around the country because that's what Upfield did. He sort of wandered around all over, and he takes Boney to the different places that he's been to. And in this instalment, Boney is in Western Australia. You don't really know why, but maybe he's there on a holiday anyway. He's there in Western Australia when he runs into an old friend by the name of John Muir. in Perth, in a street in Perth. Now, Detective Sergeant Muir is also a detective, and one has been mentored by Boney, but there's also one that doesn't really always follow Boney's methods, which are basically to show a lot of patience in terms of your analysis about what's going on. Sooner or later, things will come up, is in Boney's view. You have to just keep persevering, but not trying to rush into creating a theory that fits what you think are the facts, and therefore running with that. Anyway, Muir has basically rushed ahead with something in one particular case, and he's lost his main suspect. But he's been unable to follow the suspect interstate because he's now become engaged in the disappearance of a George Loftus in the small wheatbelt town of Burracoppin. Anyway, it's a fictitious place between Perth and Kalgoorlie in Western Australia. Now, after a discussion, Boney agrees to take on the Loftus case so that Muir can travel to Queensland and arrest and make his arrest. Boney says that what he'll do is he'll go to Burracoppin and integrate into the community as a sort of an undercover investigator and find out what's going on, and he'll make sure that Muir gets all the credit. Boney feels that he doesn't need to get any more credit, and he doesn't want to be... Boney never wants to be promoted above Detective Inspector. He loves the job that he does. He thinks this is his perfect way of doing things, and he doesn't want to end up sitting behind a desk. So he's sort of almost got a... With particular crime cases, he likes to move the kudos and all the accolades off to other people so that they get a bit of a leg up, and he just stays exactly where he is. So it's an interesting idea of having that much confidence in your ability to be able to get things done. But Boney does this. He is able to solve these particular cases. And anyway, so Boney moves to the to this small little country town, and he gets a job working on the rabbit fence, replacing posts, so that he can basically keep an eye on what's going on and what's happening around the place. And he finds out that Loftus has gone missing after having crashed his car into a pipeline ditch. So the car is still basically the halfway into this ditch at a precarious angle, and he wasn't able to get it out. But he's just gone missing, and nobody knows where he is. So Boney basically, because he's working out on the fence, is able to go off and do a little bit of investigation of the area and where the car was found. And the way that he does things is he basically just spreads his investigation across the area around where the car was found, spreading it further and further and further out, trying to find clues along the way. And of course he does. And he's able to track where Loftus left the car and where he got to about a mile down the road, but then loses track of loses track of him because his tracks just disappear. But he keeps on persisting, and he keeps on looking into what's gone on. Now, this particular crime is, and this resolution is fairly obvious very early on. If you've read any crime novels, you'll be able to work out pretty much what happened to George Loftus, and also work out, and I'm not giving anything away because Loftus is actually dead, you know pretty much early on where Loftus's body is held. Because if you're watching what, or reading and paying attention to what Boney says, you can tell that he's looked everywhere other than this one particular place. Mm-hmm. And so he's figured it out as well, but he's just checking everywhere else just to make sure. But Upfield is keeping some of those details away from you in order to try to get you to be more involved in the mystery. But the basic attraction of this particular book is more Boney's analysis of the evidence around him and how he finds it and how he deals with the people that he comes into contact with. And that's really the major thing that you're looking for here. And he's wonderful in terms of his description of the town and also of the people that he meets. One of them's called, has a nickname of the Spirit of Australia, which I think is a fantastic name for a guy who's about 80 years old, big and huge and still full of courage, strength and dependability and a lot of power. And it's just wonderful to get these things that Upfield brings out, and these descriptions of the town and the countryside. It's just all stuff that you and I would recognise straight away, David, as being a small country town anywhere, anywhere in Australia. But the big question, really, most of the time that you wade through the book, is who's Mr. Jelly?
Yes.
Because the title of the book is Mr. Jelly's Business, but the actual victim, his name is George Loftus. So who's this Mr. Jelly guy? Well, Mr. Jelly is a local landowner. And he's also disappearing. And he goes off for a few days or a couple of weeks and then comes back again. And he's a widower. He's got a couple of daughters. And the daughters get really distraught because they don't know what he's up to. Most of the people in town have got a theory. They either think that he's going off to get on a bender somewhere or he's chasing a woman somewhere. And nobody in the town seems to think either of these things are really a terribly bad thing. I mean, if the guy goes away and meets up with a woman somewhere, well, he's a widower, he's allowed to do that. And if he goes off for a bender, well, probably he's trying to drown his sorrows. But he always comes back, and he always seems to come back with more money than he left with, which seems to be really peculiar, and that doesn't really fit with either theory, because they think that if he went away and saw a woman, he's going to be spending a lot of money on her. So how does he have more money when he gets back? Nobody seems to know. But, of course, Boney gets invited to the house and he meets Mr. Jelly and he has a really good conversation with him. And Jelly really likes him a lot because he's interested in the same things that Jelly's interested in. And Boney takes it on to say, to promise the daughters that he will discover what Mr. Jelly is up to. And while it is slightly related to the disappearance of George Loftus, it's not integral to the solution of the crime. And Boney does figure out what's going on, and he gets Mr. Jelly to promise that he won't be doing this anymore, and Jelly decides that he was going to give it up anyway. And I won't tell you what it is, but I don't think it's that... It doesn't seem to really hold... It doesn't seem to be that good a solution to that sort of slight little mystery. And it is a peculiar thing that, you know, the major crime that we're dealing with here is not mentioned in the title. I believe that the American edition of this was called Murder Down Under. Oh, my God, what a terrible bloody title that is. Don't read it for that particular title. Mr. Jelly's Business is... It's a peculiar title when you get into this, and you kept on thinking, what the hell is he talking about? But anyway, you get there in the end. Now, there's enough in this interested to keep a reader going. Although it's probably not the best book in the series to start with, David. I wouldn't think that if you read this, you'd be going, oh, these mysteries aren't really all that flash. You know, I don't really think I'll read any more of these. Go back to the first one in the series, the Barrakee mystery, and then work your way through from there. And by the time you get to this one, you won't be bothered so much about the plot. You'll be more interested in how Boney works out the mystery, and also in Upfield's writing and his descriptions of Australia, the country town, and Australian people. Look, as I said, this one's not the best in the series. I only gave it 3.3 out of 5. Some of the others have been up into the high threes or fours, but I still found enough in this to really enjoy it. And isn't it always interesting, David, that when you're actually reviewing books of this sort, like Backlash and like Mr. Jelly's Business, neither of which I thought were, well, Backlash in particular, I didn't think was terribly good, but you got a lot of, you end up with a lot to say about it. Mm. And then the same thing with this one. I've had a lot to say about this particular book, Mr. Jelly's Business, and yet it's not the best in the series. And yet, See Us for Corpse, great novel, and you sort of think, well, what do I say? So why is that? Why do we actually have trouble describing what's so good about a book, but we can tell what's wrong with it? It's difficult sometimes. Anyway, I would suggest that people read this series. I think they're really wonderful, wonderful series of novels. But don't start with this one.
Right, fair enough. All right, well, finally we get to something which is not crime, Perry.
Oh, okay. Well, that gives the lie to calling this the crime fiction.
It's crime with a little touch of fantasy, I suppose.
Okay.
Now, this is actually a collection of short stories, and it's called Bliss Montage by Ling Ma. And I'm grateful to Text Publishing for sending me a review copy of this book. And it's a collection of very odd short stories. I confess, frankly, that I don't fully understand many of them, but they're all very well written, and they're well worth reading, and they give you plenty of food for thought, which is, you know, what more can you ask for? And I'll be thinking about some of them for quite a while. So all of the stories are told in the first person by various female narrators. I say various, but there are many similarities between them all. Each of them is a young woman who's either an immigrant to the United States from China or was born in America of Chinese parents. And that's hardly surprising because that's the background of the author herself. In each story, though, the narrator appears to have become or is in the process of becoming unmoored from reality. In that respect, and in several others, Ling Ma's stories remind me a lot of those of Shirley Jackson, many of which feature a young, usually married woman who suffers a breach with the normal world. I'm thinking particularly there of Jackson's stories The Tooth and The Pillar of Salt, in both of which women lose touch with reality towards the end of the story. I don't mean anything uncomplimentary by that comparison, rather the opposite. But Ling Ma's stories are unique and fascinating in their own right, but they do remind me a lot of Jackson's stories. I think there are 8 or 9 stories in the book. I'm certainly not going to try and comment on every story here, but I'll just pick out the few that had a particular impact on me. The first story in the book, Los Angeles, is surreal. The narrator tells us that she lives in a large house divided into 3 wings. She and her husband live in one wing, their children and their nannies live in the second wing, and in the third live her 100 ex-boyfriends. it is funny.
It is funny.
Yeah. Her husband only speaks in dollar signs until... until later in the story, he's reduced to talking in pennies. I've got to read this now. I'll pass the copy on to you.
Oh, yeah.
So far, so fantastic. But then reality begins to edge in. One night, the police come looking for one of the narrator's ex-boyfriends, still living in the third wing. He's called Adam, and he's accused of domestic violence, of which it seems that he has a history with the narrator. A surrealistic chase begins in which the narrator outpaces the police and runs after Adam on her own, never quite catching him. The second story, Oranges, also features the abuser Adam, but this time it's a much more realistic setting. The narrator sees Adam in the street and she follows him secretly until he reaches the apartment where he's living with another woman. It's her apartment, of course, because this is his usual method of operation, moving in with a girlfriend and sort of leeching off her. And the narrator tells this young woman, Beth, about her story, about her history with Adam and with other women who she's been in contact that Adam's abused, but she's not believed. The narrator stares into Adam's face at the end of the story and she sees there not fear or anger, but only a bewildered look of entrapment. I don't think we're meant to feel any sympathy with Adam at all, but to understand that in a way he can't escape his own behaviour, though he knows that it's personally destructive to him as well as to his victims. Of the other stories in the collection, I was particularly taken by the story simply titled G. In it, B, a young woman who's about to leave New York to live in California, visits an old childhood friend, Bonnie, and she's just visiting her to say goodbye. And we learn that when they were in their teens, they both experimented together with a drug called G. The drug, we learn, makes the user's body difficult to see, ghostly, perhaps totally invisible to other people, depending on the dose. So on this final visit, Bonnie encourages B to take one last trip on G, and they go out, naked, so as to be near invisible, to explore the places that they visited when younger. But eventually B realizes that she isn't coming down from the drug, it's not wearing off, its effects are becoming stronger. Bonnie, it seems, has overdosed her before B fades completely away, her body not only invisible but insubstantial. She sees that Bonnie has started to wear Bee's clothes, has stolen Bee's identity and erased her very existence. "Do you want to know how long I've wanted to do this?" Bonnie asks. She's a different kind of abuser. Then we have a story called Yeti Lovemaking, which is told in the second person because it's addressed to the narrator's former lover as you. So the narrator hooks up with a man in a bar, but when they get to her apartment, he reveals that he's not human. He peels off this suit that he's wearing. He reveals that he's not human, but a yeti, an abominable snowman. And his fur is so sharp that when the narrator strokes him at his invitation, her hand begins to bleed. Having sex with a yeti, it seems, requires the human lover to harden, to transform. It's a metaphor, I think, of how relationships can damage and harden those involved, particularly when they go bad. I'm skipping a number of stories. So I like the story called Office Hours quite a bit. In it, a young graduate student establishes a friendly but not sexual relationship with the head of the university's English literature faculty, and she often takes afternoon naps in his office while he works at a nearby desk. Just before he retires, he moves aside some furniture in his office and reveals a portal. The portal takes them into a nighttime world in an unknown rural location. Time never passes here. A cup of hot coffee left there days before remains hot. So the professor retires and then dies, and eventually the student graduates and joins the faculty, and ultimately the professor's office becomes her own, complete with portal. Entering the portal one day, she sees a shadowy figure who seems to be the professor, accompanied by his dog, but she is unable to catch up with him to speak to him. So is the world through the portal the land of the dead? Perhaps, but the story ends ambiguously. I've left out quite a few equally interesting stories, just so this discussion and the podcast doesn't run on forever. But all in all, I thought this was a very interesting and well-written set of stories. It certainly gives you plenty of food for thought, as I said. And the author wrote a novel called Severance a few years ago, which I must look up. So, yeah, it was very interesting. It's a very interesting collection.
Okay. All right. That sounds like... sounds like an interesting book, David. Certainly some of the stories there. I'll be happy to have a bit of a look at that one later on.
Yeah, you may not like all of them. I didn't like all of them, but some of them were just really, really thought-provoking.
Okay, all right. So how recent is this?
Very recent. I think it's just out this year.
All right. So is it an original collection of short stories, or have they been published elsewhere?
I can't tell you that. I don't know.
All right, okay, well... I'll have to have a look in the acknowledgements in the book when I get a hold of it to find out about it. All right, well, that sounds good. Sounds interesting. All right, I think we're done.
Yeah, we've been going for quite a while.
Well, we have been. I think we're done completely. So we're a bit late with this particular episode because of various things. I was feeling pretty tired after my trip back into Australia last week, so we put it off for a little while, and then other things got in the way. But we're back on track, and we'll try and get back on schedule for our next episode, David.
So if we record in 2 weeks, then?
Yes, we will record in 2 weeks and get back to that, and then do a 3-weekly after that. Because we have, over the last couple of months, been doing our reading research for next episode, which will be... the Hugo Time Machine again, this time for the year 1969. A very, very interesting year for science fiction, David. So we shall be talking about the fiction categories for that particular set of Hugo Awards next time.
And we may possibly have room to talk about something else. We'll see.
Okay, all right, we'll see what happens. We'll see what we can get to. All right, okay, thanks, David.
It's all right, and we'll see you next time.
Yeah, see you in a couple of weeks. Okay, cheers. Bye.
Bye.